Hello, listeners. You may have noticed I disappeared for a bit. A few days ago, there was an incident on the property next to ours, and some of our property was heavily damaged and, in fact, destroyed. Don't worry, we're all fine. All the cats are fine. All the chickens are fine. All the beer is fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you? I have to keep everything vague for the time being, as the insurance agencies have to negotiate, and I don't want to affect any of that. Once we get the okay, then I can go into more detail. Anyway, the bunker is intact, and the show must go on. So, here we go! Welcome, welcome, welcome! If you are ready to listen to me drink and talk, then I'm glad you've loaded me down and queued me up, because it's time for another episode of All Have a Beer and Talk! Convenient. My name is Gary, and I like beer and technology. So the way this show works is that I find an interesting beer to describe to you. Then I drink it while I tell you some interesting technology-related stories that I read on the internet in the time it takes me to drink that beer. Things are finally no longer in the upper 90s here in Portland, Oregon, so it's a great time to cool down even more with the best beverage known to humankind. Which is beer! Surprise! Because I have paralysis of choice when it comes to beer, I use a device called the randomizer to choose each weekly beer. So, here we go! And I want a drink. Hooray! The randomizer has selected Southern Tier Brewing Company's Krampus, a 9% ABV Imperial Helles Lager. Helles are a special golden German lager that was created to compete with Czech Pilsners that were all the rage in the late 19th century. They are full-bodied, mildly sweet, and light-colored with low bitterness. Fun fact, Helles is German for bright. So you could say I'm not so much smart as I am Helles. That doesn't make any sense. But anyway, let me switch to the beer mic so you can experience the sound of the pour. Lovely. It has a wonderful smell. It has a bouquet. It is a golden orange yellow with a little off-white head and just smells really fantastic. Little cereal notes, a nice floralness to it. This is going to be great. Well, that's unexpected. It's fantastic. It has a little bit more of a bitterness kick than I expected, and also has resiny notes, which is also very intriguing. I guess because it's an Imperial Helles, means that it's been embiggened. A lot of proportions in the brew process have been doubled up to make it a much stronger beer overall. So I guess that makes sense. Give those Czech pills Helles, Germans. Hey, guess what? Business Insider reports that drinking alcohol may lower your risk of diabetes. A new study was published involving 70,000 Danish people attempting to determine how alcohol consumption was possibly associated with low diabetes risk, and also determine if the type of alcohol and or the frequency in which people imbibe had any additional effect. The researchers used data from the Danish Health Examination Survey, a voluntary health study conducted from 2007 to 2008. After excluding participants in the health survey that already had diabetes, were pregnant during the survey, or didn't provide their drinking habits, the researchers focused on whether or not survey participants developed diabetes within 5 years of the conclusion of the survey. What they found may surprise you. The data points to the fact that those participants who were the least likely to develop diabetes drank 3 to 4 times a week, with men knocking back 14 bevies a week and women imbibing 9 drinks a week, having the lowest risk. People who didn't drink at all had the highest risk of developing diabetes, but drinking lowered the risk to a certain point. When going past those 14 or 9 drinks a week, the risk starts rising, but at a much lower rate than the non-drinkers. The type of booze also had an effect in lowering risk. Wine for men and women had the lowest risk. For men, beer had an equally low risk, and women who drank spirits actually had a higher risk of developing diabetes. Now, these results do not mean you should drink 9 to 14 beverages 3 to 4 times a week, and the study did not differentiate between risk of developing type 1 or type 2 diabetes, but the results do add to the hypothesis that regular alcohol consumption, in moderation, may improve health by lowering blood pressure and dilating blood vessels. And I'll drink to that. you know, what other benefit booze consumption may have. It might help you have a stronger memory. Ars Technica reports on a study in Scientific Reports that seems to show that after studying information, a little alcohol consumption seems to help the brain in sorting the new information for recall later. In the study, the researchers gathered 88 alcohol-drinking adults between the ages of 18 and 53. I should point out that this study took place in the United Kingdom, where the legal drinking age is a sensible 18 years old. Anyway, the experiments were run in two phases at the participants' homes. Phase 1, the learning phase, would start at 6 p.m., and participants would play a word game. They would listen to 24 made-up words, which were similar to real words, except extra letters were added, like Cuff-a-V or Dr. B. The words were repeated 36 times in different orders. After an hour, the participants were tasked with remembering as many of the words as they could when given parts of the words, like D-O-C-T-O-R blank. Then they would remember it was Doctorb. At about 8 p.m., half the participants were ordered to drink. Science. And as long as they kept track, they could drink as much as they wanted. Brits must be a thirsty bunch, because the mean amount of alcohol consumed by the drinking group in the study was 82.6 grams. So the average standard U.S. drink is about 14 grams, so that's about 6 drinks per participant. Damn. After 10 p.m., when the drinking participants were tipsy, the picture challenge started. Participants were shown a series of 128 images and asked to categorize them as either indoor or outdoor objects. For example, a video cassette would be considered an indoor item because it belongs in a museum, and a giraffe would be normally considered an outdoor item. Normally. Then the participants were shown a jumble of 192 images, some of which were from the first set of 128, some similar to images from the first set, and some completely new images. The article gives the example of an image being the same one of a giraffe, an image of a giraffe in a completely different position, and a never-before-seen image of a hat. Fun times. The participants had to categorize the image as old, similar, or new. And with that, phase one concluded, and the drinkers were allowed to keep drinking if they wished, and everyone was left to decide when they wanted to sleep for the night. Phase two started at 10 a.m. the next day. All the participants retook the word test, then did the image test again, but with a slightly different set of 192 images, and the test concluded there. The results? The sober participants showed a slight decline in remembering the words from the word test between the evening and morning sessions, but the drinkers were much better the next morning, statistically significantly so. The image tests were a little more inconclusive. Both the sober and drinking participants performed about the same. So what does all of this mean? The theory is that alcohol can disrupt memory encoding in the hippocampus, essentially preventing the new learned knowledge from being overwritten by new memories, as the new memories can't be properly stored due to the presence of alcohol. This lets the pre-drinking knowledge have more time to settle in, improving recall later. So if I ever decide to go back to school, I'll be sure to drink after studying, and after just about everything. It'll help me learn and remember. Or you could just use lasers to help you remember things. New Scientist posted about experiments by Christine Denny at Columbia University that seems to show that lost memories may be able to be retrieved by artificially activating the neurons in which those memories are stored. And this has the potential to retrieve memories thought lost forever in Alzheimer's sufferers. The researchers used mice, of course, in a series of experiments. They genetically engineered special mice whose neurons would glow yellow when storing memory and red when being accessed for the memory, and bred two strains, one normal and one with the mouse equivalent of human Alzheimer's. They subjected both sets of mice to a memory test. They were exposed to a lemony scent and then given an electric shock, and the neuron that glowed yellow was located and logged during the experiment. A week later, they were given a whiff of that same lemony scent. The normal mice froze in fear, anticipating the shock, and the researchers saw the neuron that had stored the shock memory glowed red, indicating recall of a previous memory. The Alzheimer's mice, when reintroduced to the lemon scent, froze half as much as the normal mice, and the neurons that glowed red did not match the neuron that had stored the first memory, suggesting they were recalling incorrect memories. Denny said that this may explain why people with Alzheimer's experience false memories. Using optogenetics, where neurons can be activated with light, the researchers were able to reactivate the shock memory in the Alzheimer's mice by shining a blue laser on the original memory neuron, via a fiber optic cable implanted in the mouse skull. They were able to stimulate the neuron, causing the mice to freeze again when smelling the lemon. The next steps, before you can just zap your head to remember your damn password, will be confirming the same memory storage and recall neuron system is in human brains, as they are much more complex.
Lasers!
Hey, you know what's super easy to learn and doesn't require to drink afterwards to remember or use lasers to remember? Making handmade paper, of course. You can learn all about it at this show's sponsor, Pulp & Deckel. Pulp & Deckel is Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio, and its mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with workshops, demonstrations, and by creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products. Browse the rotating selection of papermaking workshops, check out membership options, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out all the amazing things we do with the art of papermaking by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. Mention I'll have a beer and talk, and we might give you something special. A pair of researchers at the Department of Psychology of the University of Warwick in the UK wrote a paper last month in the journal Behavior Research Methods, according to Gizmodo. That's the whole story. Just kidding. What did they publish in that paper? The funniest and unfunniest words in the human language. The appreciation of humor is a fundamental, albeit mysterious, part of human cognition, they wrote in the paper. The aim of providing this data is to help enrich the resources available for understanding the cognitive, developmental, and applied aspects of humor. They took 4,997 common words from previous research, then enlisted 823 participants from Amazon's Mechanical Turk Small Task Service to rate a random selection of 200 words from the 4,997 on a 5-point scale, with 5 being the most humorous and 1 being the most humorless. I am going to read to you some of the results from the data, but only from the funny column. We don't really need to go into the humorlessness at this point in human history. If you want to know the most humorless words, I suggest you read the original article. You can find the link in the show notes. Anyway, here are the top 10 most humorous words, starting with number 10. Twerp, ass, egghead, bebop, tinkle, nitwit, hooter, booby, tit, and booty. There's a lot of data to parse from the results of the study, but Gizmodo called attention to a list of funny words broken down by 2 age groups, one labeled younger and one labeled older. The 5 funniest words to youngins are, starting from 5, hunchback, germ, joint, reform, and goatee. Okay. For the oldsters, it's burlesque, jingle, squint, birthright, and caddy. Oldsters are weird. Anyway, several scientists have pointed out that this isn't very accurate. People who offer their services on the Mechanical Turk platform skew young and liberal, and using an initial dataset of just 4,997 words is actually pretty small. But if you can say that, scientifically, booty is the funniest word in the English language, I don't care how accurate it is. NASA posted a job opening, and most of the internet ran with a misinterpretation of what the job actually was. You see, NASA was looking for a full-time planetary protection officer, and it pays upwards of $124,000 a year. Clearly, no one read past the job title, as most of the posts were on the lines of, NASA wants to hire you to protect us from aliens, which isn't what the job is, at all. Mashable was the first site that I saw to put the record straight, so here's what they say the job is actually all about. It's a position in the Office of Safety and Mission Assurance for Planetary Protection, and the main duty is to, basically, make absolutely sure that microbes from Earth do not get on any spacecraft we send out into space so they can't contaminate other planets. And the same applies for the reverse. They need to make sure any samples collected from other bodies in space do not contaminate our planet. Hey, if you have broad engineering expertise, with at least 1 year of utilizing those skills at the GS-15 level, have advanced knowledge of planetary protection, its requirements and mission categories, and a degree in physical science, engineering, or mathematics that included 24 semester hours in physical science and or related engineering science such as mechanics, dynamics, material properties, and electronics, or a combination of education and experience in those areas, feel free to apply! I only have a theoretical degree in physics, so I think I am dangerously underqualified. In the future, you might be eating food made from just electricity and carbon dioxide. Don't believe me. Well, it's true, and I read about it on Engadget. Researchers at the Lappeenranta University of Technology and VTT Technical Research Center of Finland have derived a way of making a single-cell protein using just CO2 and electricity. Currently, it takes about 2 weeks to create 1 gram of the protein, but you know what? That's 10 times more efficient than photosynthesis. Great, but why? The goal is to create an alternate food source for livestock, which would reduce the enormous environmental impact on the environment that traditional livestock feed production requires. Freeing up that land and creating simple feed on demand would be a benefit for all. This could also, with further development, be fit for human consumption. One of the principal scientists on the project said, "In the long term, protein created with electricity is meant to be used in cooking and products as it is. The mixture is very nutritious, with more than 50% protein and 25% carbohydrates. The rest is fats and nucleic acids. The consistency of the final product can be modified by changing the organisms used in the production. The researchers are working hard to increase the speed and efficiency of the process, and the next step is to begin a pilot project to test the protein. I see this as being extremely useful, if a little bland, for space exploration. An astronaut crew could conceivably just recycle their CO2 scrubbers and turn it all into food for long journeys in the black." Emus. They're hilarious, a little terrifying. Running a farm of them is a great harebrained get-rich-quick scheme, and research into their genetics just might help humans with limb deformities. Emus are members of a group called Ratites, which are large, flightless birds, which include ostriches, cassowaries, and even kiwis. Emus are on average 5.5 to 6 feet tall, but their wings are only 8 inches long, completely incapable of allowing an emu to fly. But they aren't completely useless. Emus use them to cool down in the Australian heat, according to Parks Victoria. Researchers from Monash University in Australia have been sequencing the genes of embryonic emus and run across one that is activated during wing development, called NKX2.5. The researchers had a brainwave. What if this gene is what controls the size of the emu's wings? They injected the gene into some chicken embryos, and the resulting chickens developed tiny emu-like wings instead of normal-sized wings. I don't know whether to laugh or cry about that. So, great for making buffalo wings for little people, but so what? Well, what would you say if I told you that NKX2.5 is found in humans as well? It's true. NKX2.5 is a well-known regulator of heart development and is mutated in some children born with heart defects, Craig Smith, an associate professor at Monash University, said in a statement. The gene may also be relevant to human limb development because it could be involved in previously unexplained congenital limb reductions. Obviously, more research into NKX2.5 is needed to fully understand it and learn to manipulate it, but hey, it's great for making mini wings! Guys, well, this show is supported by Pulp and Nickel and listeners just like you. If you get value or entertainment from the show, maybe you too would like to support me. You can always hire me for some voice and audio production work. I can do voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some adequate audio production. If you feel you or someone you know might have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and, yes, my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckle.com. That is gary@pulpanddeckle.com. Rates are reasonable. And if you could be so kind to rate and review the show on iTunes, the more I have at discoverability will go up for people looking for a beery tech podcast on iTunes. And you can also support the show directly with money. If you enjoy my show each week, you can donate at least $1 a month to the show at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabatradio. Go to patreon.com/ihabitradio and become my patron. You'll be joining a very attractive and intelligent group that already support me there. Hooray! So that was episode 96. Wow. That means episode 100 is getting really close. And I haven't put any thought into doing anything special to mark the occasion other than just making a show like usual. Do you have any ideas? Should I bring back some guests? Have some new guests? Highlight some great segments? Play a little bit of the unaired pilot? Do you have any burning questions about the show that I haven't talked about? The suggestion box is open. Oh, and I gave that Hellas. So that means that it is time for me to go. Please tell your family, friends, neighbors, pets, plants, aliens, and yes, emus about the show and that they can find it on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, and on Spreaker. And please send me feedback, story suggestions, and beer recommendations to Gary@pulpanddeckle.com or on the Twitters and Instagram at iHabitRadio or even on the Facebook at facebook.com/iHabitRadio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!
Professor, what's another word for pirate treasure?
Well, I think it's booty.